Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday and Sunday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is Jim Murphy. James Robert Murphy is his writing name. He's an author of several books, and he has quite a story to tell, actually, because he's a Renaissance man, done a little bit of everything. And Jim, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Now, as I mentioned, you have a little bit of everything. You've done a little bit of everything. You're a musician. You're a writer. You used to work at a history museum. I don't know if you still do or not. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, why you came to El Paso.
Right. I've been a musician for 40 years. In 1992, I started the New York State Blues Festival. I'm from Syracuse, New York. I worked for my father in remodeling almost my entire life, and then I got into the arts pretty heavily. And I was a development director. I quit my father's job and became a development director for the Cultural Resources Council up in Syracuse, New York. That was the first real job I ever had. And I, through the Blues Festival up there, I learned how to write grants and raise money. And I just kept doing that and became a development officer. And in 2004, I came down here to El Paso. This is where my wife is from. And got a job eventually with the city of El Paso at the Museum of History, and I've been there for almost 9 years now.
As far as the blues goes, is this something that you grew up learning, loving the blues? Because I'm not sure how old you were when you started that blues festival, but, you know, every generation has their music and the parents saying, why are you listening to that? You were a blues fan all the time?
No, but Syracuse, oddly, is a very small city. Everybody thinks anything from New York is gigantic. Syracuse is about less than half the size of El Paso. But it's got a thriving blues community. I mean, there's blues musicians everywhere and really excellent musicians. So, you know, I grew up in that environment and became one of the blues players in town and recorded tons of material. Even when I lived in Austin for a while and I recorded there, my whole music thing has been to record as much as I can. And the four-box CD that I put out last year, A History of Blues, was a compilation of recordings from 1978 through 2008. And just picking and choosing 48 songs over the years that I really liked and put this box set together that won a Syracuse Area Music Award for Best Blues CD. They call it a Sammy up there instead of a Grammy.
When you got that, was that working with musicians from here in El Paso? Because you started a blues group or association club here in El Paso as well, correct?
Right. All the recordings on my CD are from Syracuse musicians over the years. I haven't done a whole lot of recording since moving to El Paso, but that was all Syracuse-based musicians, and I think that's why they allowed me to enter it in the Sammy contest and still live here.
And the box set is available through, what, Amazon or the website?
You can get songs through Amazon, but the best thing to do is to go to austinjimmymurphy.com and get a hold of me, and I can hook you up with a box set. It's so beautiful. It's four CDs and a 12-page booklet that explains when the songs were written, who performed on them, the lyrics, everything. It's really a nice package.
You are also an author, as I mentioned, and the book we're going to talk about today is My Life Before I Decided to Commit Suicide. Interesting title.
Good title. I like it. You know, it is what it says. It's my life before I decided to commit suicide, which begins at my childhood and leads up to the end of my first marriage when I contemplated committing suicide. And in essence, it's a funny book with a lot of unique little mishaps that happen along the way. And it looks back, it starts with, you know, what made me do this? I'm already hanging in this raftered area. But your mind thinks, well, how did I get to this point? So the book starts going back, and my brain starts going back and thinking of all the things that led up to that point in time. And, they're cute little mishaps.
When you were there at that moment, what made you decide to say, I'm not going to do it?
Well, I think most people go through some sort of a stage where they've just had enough. Nothing's working out. And the purpose of this book is that once you read through this, you'll see that even though there's a lot of fighting and drugs and everything else in this book, it's not all that bad. That period of depression only lasts for 2 or 3 years. And after that, if you can make it through that short period of time, I mean, if, everything, you start to figure things out after that, because that depressing period is really hard to get through. And if you can just have confidence in yourself, a little bit of confidence, and not do what you think is, you know, what you have to do at that point in time, you'll find out that life has a lot to give. So that's the point of this. Make it through it. Think back on all those terrible things. There's a funny side to all those terrible things. It's a silly thing. It's stupid stuff. So it's not that serious. Just got to push through.
One of the things that, and I know you're not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but there have been studies that, you know, sometimes boys take some longer to mature. Takes them till about they're 25 or so, and so they may go through that area where they don't know what they're doing, they don't know what they want to do, and then girls mature quicker. But at the same time, sometimes more young girls attempt suicide because of emotional things and stuff like that. So do you think that you being a young man and going through what you did perhaps contributed to the fact that it's more prevalent perhaps in young men because of our maturity?
Well, I certainly had a tough time maturing. Every relationship that I was in failed, and it was because I was a jealous person, misunderstanding the fact that the person you're going out with, they are themselves and you are yourself, and you have to trust in that. Trust is a very hard thing to do. It's easy for us to flirt around, but we don't want to see our partners flirt around. So, you know, learning that it's okay for everyone to be who they are, and that this person who you are with wants to be with you. And you have to accept them for who they are, and they accept you for who you are. That's a hard thing to do.
You see stories and you hear stories about guys who have sexual conquest, and all of a sudden they're macho men or heroes. But a woman does it, and she's called a, you know, pardon the word,
right,
slut.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, or mm-hmm. It's so different. And kids are exposed to so many things nowadays that I'm not sure if you agree with this, but some people say that this generation is perhaps having it the hardest than any other generation as far as teenagers go.
Well, there's certainly a lot more exposure to everything these days. I mean, we didn't have anything growing up. You know, there was a phone in the house and that was it. And it's, you look back on that and it's like, how did we ever get through that? How did you get by without being able to communicate with people? But those were really great times. I mean, you had to walk somewhere. You had to hitchhike somewhere. You had to find a ride somewhere. There was no other way to get anywhere, no other way to communicate. But I think men and young women and young men, you know, it does take – I think women are more forgiving than men. So – but being more mature, they accept your ways, like I was saying earlier, then it's easier for us to accept.
Some of the reviews that you got on this book say that it's a very good book. You got some praise. We're comparing it to J.D. Salinger's book,
right,
Catcher in the Rye. And also the fact that they say, well, you know, it's what every teenager goes through no matter what generation. It just depends on, like you said, you had a phone in the house, but there were other things that perhaps tempted you or got you in trouble. And one of the things that I was wondering about is when we were kids, we used to watch the Tarzan movies, and usually somebody would get stuck in quicksand. And you open up with talking about quicksand.
Right,
tell me about that.
Well, when I was 2 years old or so, we grew up in a neighborhood in Auburn, New York, and we were one of the first houses in that neighborhood. So across the street was this open lot, and, you know, upstate New York is a very rainy, muddy turf, and there was a muck hole out there, and I got my brand-new boot stuck in this muck hole, and to me, I was being sucked into this chocolate chasm of the underworld and couldn't get out, and my brother and sister are standing there, and they're not even helping me. So early on to me, as a little kid, it's like, you know, I'm going to have to fight for myself here because I'm all alone here. And I ended up losing my boot in the quicksand, so I say it was quicksand, and making my way back to the house and realizing that, man, I'm here all alone. I'm going to have to figure this out.
But when you describe that scene, and it sounds, you make it sound so dramatic, and I'm sure to you it was very, very dramatic.
Absolutely. And then, you know, a couple days later, I get chased back to the house in that same field from a dragonfly, and you know, to me, that dragonfly was as big as I was. And it was just, you know, they chasing me and beating me and batting me around and stuff. And again, my brother and sister are standing there. Nothing's around them. But to me, there were millions of dragonflies and chasing little tiny human beings. And I just happened to be the target.
And tell us about your father and the episode with the Jeep.
Well, my dad had run out of gas. We only had one vehicle at the time. So I, in my own mind, was always the chosen one out of all the kids. He was a carpenter, so I was the son of a carpenter. I was Jesus. And so he took me to hitchhike with him to get some gas. And when the Jeep stopped and let us off, I was in the back of the Jeep. I tripped over something and fell out of the back. And in my own mind, I went into a swan dive, a beautifully formed dive, and I'm going to land perfectly. But I end up smashing my face into the pavement because I can't fly, really. And I break my nose. And so he takes me back to the house. Everything's all good. He saves my life. That's the first time in this book he saves my life. And we go back to the house. Well, come to find out, I'm put in the foyer of our living room, and he puts a stepladder behind me, and I'm sitting in a chair, and all the neighbors and blocks of people coming into the house to climb up this ladder to look down over my head to see my broken nose. And my mother's selling wine out there, and everybody's selling cotton candy. It turns into a circus freak show, and I'm the target of it. And so the purpose of it is that every true Irishman has a broken nose. And all these people were saying, "Oh, Bobby, nice job. That's beautiful," and kissing my mother's hand. And it's just it really did happen. I fell out of the Jeep, broke my nose, and the rest of it is a wonderful little twist on the story.
You mentioned, and for the benefit of our listeners, and so they can get curious and go out and get the book, is the fact that you said this was the first time that my father saved my life.
Right. He saves my life a couple times. He actually morphs into a gigantic... I'm smoking up in our barn a cigarette I stole from my mom, a Territon, and I think I'm all hidden and all doing fine. And we just moved to Syracuse, New York, and we had this big barn in our backyard, and he comes up the stairs and finds me and, you know, isn't happy about it and morphs into this gigantic... Well, my mom's a spy, for one thing. Assumingly, she commits a couple of murders in this book. My dad is a morphs into superheroes, so he drags me out of the barn, and he teaches me a good lesson there. But he saves my life in the beginning, and in the end, it comes full circle. And a couple times in this book, you'll see the relationship of him and the non-progression of my life, and in the end, it's almost the exact same thing that happens in the beginning.
You mentioned that you were caught smoking a cigarette, and according to your book, cigarettes were not a good thing in your house, I guess, because your grandmother banned your grandfather from smoking, and then your father always had a White Owl cigar in his mouth.
Right. I never met my grandfather, either of my grandfathers, and in this instance, my Grandma Murphy, you know, she chased him out of our lives because she was a teetotaler and he enjoyed a beer or whatever. I don't know because I never knew him. And, you know, he smoked his cigarettes. So those little things, because he smoked and drank beer or whatever, she booted him out and we never got to know him.
And as far as your father, he was not allowed to smoke cigars in the house either, right?
Right, right.
It was a smoke-free environment.
But he could smoke a pipe in there for some odd reason. And, you know, he might have... he was a carpenter, like I say, and he would say, I remember him sitting in the corner reading the Post Standard or the Herald Journal up in Syracuse and smoking his pipe. And, you know, it was a pretty elegant scene for a lowly carpenter.
So it looked like something like out of a Norman Rockwell picture.
Oh, it was beautiful, yeah. And, you know, he had two pipes. He had a straight one and the curved one like Sherlock Holmes. And, you know, he packed his own tobacco and sat there and read the paper and... This is great.
It sounds like as a child you, and you probably still do, have a very vivid imagination. You have to be a good writer. Tell us a little bit about some of the other adventures that perhaps are covered in this book. And actually, what age period are we talking about?
Well, it starts out, like I said, when I was 2 years old. And I go from the Auburn era, from the time I was 2 to 4 or 5 years old. Then we moved to Syracuse, and that's from 5 to 9 years old. And then we moved to Nedro, a little town, 2,000 population, 1 square mile town south of Syracuse. And, you know, everybody knows everybody, and that's where I pretty much grew up through my high school years. And, you know, there's in high school, of course, back in the late 60s and early 70s was it was a lot of, you know, the fight for freedom, civil rights was going on. And me and this little black kid that used to live down the neighborhood, all the blacks in Nedro lived on the other side of Salina Street, you know, it wasn't like the other side of the tracks. They just happened to live down by the creek down there, Onondaga Creek. So every time I would go down there, me and this little black kid would get into a wrestling match. It was just our thing. When we saw each other, we'd hold each other in headlocks and the scissors and squeeze each other for a couple of hours and lay there in the middle of the street. And then we'd get up and shake hands and laugh it off and go home. So I get into a pretty good description of our battle for civil rights and how he knew and more about civil rights than I did, of course, because we were a white family, and what do we know about civil rights? But they were fighting for it, and they all lived together down at the end of town. There's a beautiful story in there about his birth, which I, you know, made up, but the Nedro African tribal women get together. His mom passes out when he's being born, and he's all out, but his head is still stuck inside of her. So they perform this ritual where they crush these yellow flowers and get bullfrog heads, all these heads of animals that live submerged in, you know, beaver head and all these heads, milk snakes. And birthing mother puts her breast milk on these, and they crush it all up. And it's this beautiful scene of sparkling life from the woman, the mother-to-be, and that warmth generated by these leaves and everything that they crushed up gives her life again and allows her the ability to have birth to her son. Well, he's born with a big, long head like you see the Egyptians, and I've got this big, fat head. So you got this little black kid with a big, long head because he was stuck in his mother's birth canal, and me, my mother might have had trouble too. I got this big, fat head, and we're out in the street fighting it out. It's a beautiful story.
You know, the stories that you're talking about and some of the things that you're doing— going back to this generation hasn't experienced that because of social media, because of multitasking, because of texting, because of everything. They don't go outside and they're not chased by dragonflies. They don't get stuck in quicksand. They don't wrestle with their partners, with their friends or anything like that. Kids don't do that anymore. And what you're describing here is almost like a modern Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer adventure.
Yeah, I think it is. There's some wonderful characters in this book, and they're all real characters. I originally wrote the book with all real names, and then someone said, you know, you might want to change these names. And I'm like, I would want to be involved in this. But as I read through it for the millionth time, it was like, you know, maybe it would be best to change some names. So I changed all of the names except where there's no harm done. But I'll tell you another little story, if you don't mind. When I was in 10th grade, I was the only 10th grader on the varsity basketball team. And I started, so I was a good in sports. And my brother, myself, and one of the other boys, they were both juniors. I was a sophomore. We got kicked off the basketball team the next year. And it was this other kid's sister-in-law who reportedly saw us during the summer drinking at a party. So his sister-in-law turns us into the Board of Education, and we all get kicked off the team. My parents went up there, and, you know, they were uneducated, but they fought. They went to every basketball game that was ever held there, and they fought and fought and fought, but we were kicked off the team. The coach, a brand-new coach, was from South Onondaga. He never stood up and protected us. So we're booted off. I never played sports again. My brother never played sports again, and Mike Horrigan never spoke to his sister-in-law again. And so the coach, come to find out, never even had a teaching degree. So they hire this guy because he's a hometown boy. We get kicked off the team. They have to fire him because he doesn't have a degree. So our sports career is ruined. Later in life, and this is a true story, he just bummed around the rest of his life, from what I understand. He killed himself. Not over that incident, of course, but nonetheless, he ends up killing himself. His son kills himself. So I just found this out the other day because the other basketball guy who got kicked off the team got wind of this book and read that story, and he got back to me with the real thing that I didn't know about. So it's just a – it's interesting that people are reading this from my hometown and have their versions of what really happened in some of these instances. But that's an incredible story. My brother got pulled out of high school at that time and sent to a private boys' school. He's working at the University of Southern Alabama now, so he got a real education. I mean, we were poor, you know, an education. It was get to work. It wasn't get an education when I was brought up. And so we all learned how to work. Except for him. He went to college, and he's a professor.
You just mentioned that, you know, some of your hometown buddies have read this. So tell me a little bit about – I talked a little bit about the reviewers. What about some of your hometown buddies? What do they think of the book?
Well, you know, it hasn't been out there that long. But everyone that I've sold it to or given it to, one way or the other, they're either in the process of reading it or they have read it. And I'll tell you, they all really like it, and it's like I say, it's a humorous book, and I think it's made for everyone. And being a writer who self-published, my next question is, well, what the heck do I do with it now? You know, everybody loves this book. What do you do with something that you've written that everybody likes? And I don't think they're pulling my leg. I think it's a good story. How do you get it to the next level? That's my next quest, I suppose.
I would think that probably social media would be one of the things, and push it on Facebook and something like that. And because, you know, there are so many things out there that people don't know about.
Right.
And then once they find out, give you an example. We did not have a Facebook page until recently, about a month ago. Norma put it together, and all of a sudden it's exploded.
Yeah.
And everybody is going to it.
Yeah.
So what about – I was wondering, and people, our listeners may be wondering about this. What about your little friend that you used to wrestle with? Have you kept in touch with him? Is he still around?
Or? No idea. No idea. You know, out of high school, we lost track of each other, and I have no idea where he is.
And as far as books go, you've written several books, and one of them, sadly, because it's – and I don't know if you want to talk about this, but it was about local people,
right?
From El Paso, some movie stars, some other people,
mm-hmm.
And from what I saw, the gallery, it's awesome. I was just wondering, how long did it take you to do that research? And I guess working at the Museum of History, you've always been interested in history.
Well, no, I didn't get interested in history until I was hired by the Museum of History.
Okay.
You know, I'm a development director, so wherever I can bring money to
money.
The table, yeah. But that book is called Legendary Locals of El Paso, and it was – my first book was El Paso 1850 to 1950, which was put out by Arcadia Publishing, and that's done quite well. And so they did this other series called Legendary Locals of Wherever. So I got in on that. And it took me about a year to put it together. And, you know, those picture books are – you have to lay them out just like this book or any book. I mean, you've got to lay the whole thing out perfectly. They have a template, and you've got to put all the pieces together. So I go through this whole process of doing this. And when I was researching the movie stars and people like that who were from El Paso, well, I got that information from the internet, you know. And I had one full page of all of my internet sources that I went to, and they would not accept that. In my first book, I did the same thing. I had a page in the back, a reference page of all the internet sites I visited, and they accepted that. This time, they wouldn't accept it. And I was like, well, you know, how am I supposed to find out information about all these people? There's so many sites out there with basic information. All that information's the same on any site you go to. So it's true. You know what I mean? They wouldn't accept it. They refused it. I tried to, you know, I did a little bit of fighting with them, and that book never got published.
Are there intentions to maybe push it some more?
I went to the local publishers here, and one of them doesn't publish local things. They're more on the national level. And the other one, I would have had to have paid to have had it done, which is, you know, not something I can afford to do.
And how did you select these people? Because you have quite a number of people in that book.
Yeah. Well, through my, I've been here 10 years now, and I started at El Paso Opera. So I was introduced to a lot of, I won't say important, but a lot of folks that dealt with the opera. So I just went back through all my memories and everything like that, and who do I really know in this town, or who have I met along the way that I think, plays somewhat of an important role in El Paso. And the difficult thing I found out about that book was, you know, it has to come to an end. So even though you, there may be another 50 people you would have liked to have put in there, then you just don't have room for it. You know, you're allowed a couple hundred photos and that's it. So you, the choices were tough because I had to leave people out. I could have gone on for another 200 photos easy. But it was, it was sports, people in sports and movies, like we say. And there were men, women, different categories, different chapters that I came up with, 9 different chapters, I'll say. And it was very well put together, and, you know, it's just sitting there now.
Even our own Norma Martinez.
Yeah. That's right, because Norma's been a friend of mine. She's the old blues gal here, and she's always treated me with respect, and we've gotten along very good.
And she's a great voice, the voice of the radio station.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Oh, I'll say she does. I don't know what she doesn't do.
Now, tell me, for our listeners, my life before I decided to commit suicide, where can they get a copy of this book? Is there a website they go to?
You can go to jamesrobertmurphy.com and contact me there. It's jamesrobertmurphy.com. I'm easy to get a hold of. My local phone number, if you don't mind if I give it, is 915-526-0719. And, I'm call the History Museum, whatever you want, and I'm pretty accessible.
And you mentioned also at the beginning of the program the boxed CD set, and that's a different website because you have your name, James Robert Murphy, as an author, but you have a different name as a musician.
Right, Austin Jimmy Murphy. And so I have 2 different websites going on out there.
And what is that website again?
It's austinjimmymurphy.com.
And that's where they can get the box set.
Yeah.
And as far as if people have additional questions, can they call you at this number that you just gave us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You can contact me via email. If you go to either of those sites, my contact information is on there.
Okay. And again, the website for the book is jamesrobertmurphy.com. The name of the book is My Life Before I Decided to Commit Suicide, a witty expose of life in small-town America. And I've just read a few of these stories, a few of the chapters, but I think you'll love this book. And we're just proud to have a hometown. Once you've been here several years, you're here considered a hometown boy.
Get me a decade in.
Yes. So thank you very much, Jim, for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This show, along with past episodes of Perspectives, are available on our website, ktep.org. And may be downloaded as a podcast only for personal use. Any rebroadcasts of Perspectives or portions thereof are not allowed by law, except with the express written consent of the producers and host of Perspectives. All rights reserved by KTEP, the University of Texas at El Paso, and the UT Board of Regents.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.